Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers, from 1988. Directed by Dwight H. Little, screenplay by Alan B. McElroy, and story by McElroy, Benjamin Ruffner, Larry Ratner, Donnie Lipsius, and possibly an uncredited Shem Bitterman, because this movie went through something of an evolution on its journey to the screen. There's a perception that the franchise lay fallow for a long period between Halloween 3 and Halloween 4 because 3 was a box office bomb, but it really wasn't. It made $14.4 million on a budget of $2.5 million, which is a financial success by any standard. Any standard, that is, save for the massive return on investment that the original Halloween had. Mustafa Akkad and Irwin Yablans, who owned 40% of the rights between them, felt like they were leaving money on the table by not continuing with Michael Myers' story. Dino De Laurentiis was no longer in the picture, his two-movie deal with Yablans having expired after Halloween 3. But John Carpenter and Deborah Hill, who also owned 40% of the rights, had no interest in making another Michael Myers stalks teenagers on Halloween movie, and the film couldn't go through until all parties were agreed on a screenplay. The fifth partner, Joseph Wolf, was Yablans' partner until they had a falling out over profits owed but not paid to Akkad, and didn't appear to hold any strong opinions on the franchise's direction from what I could find. As always for the Halloween films, my main source is the Taking Shape series of books by Dustin McNeil and Travis Mullins. With both sides refusing to budge, the Halloween franchise languished in limbo for 4 long years. But then Big Trouble in Little China happened. Although this is one of my all-time favorite movies, with sadly not quite enough horror content for me to justify covering it on this podcast, it was a box office flop that capped off a string of underperforming pictures, at least underperforming by the standards of the man who'd helmed the single most profitable independent film ever at the time. The Fog and Escape from New York did alright, as did Christine, but The Thing and Starman both struggled to make back their production budget. And when Big Trouble in Little China made only $11 million on a budget of $25 million, well, Carpenter felt a lot of pressure to show the studios that he could still make a hit. A brief aside, the only time I'm ever interested in the mechanics of profit like this are when they materially impact the creative process on a movie, which is why you don't often hear me talk about how much money a film made. Comparing box office returns is another popularity metric, like Rotten Tomato scores, that I really don't care about because they don't really get into the why of a movie and why it works and doesn't work for somebody. Anyway, Carpenter hired horror novelist Dennis Etchison, who'd previously written the novelizations of The Fog, Halloween 2, and Halloween 3, to come up with a screenplay under his guidance. The two settled on the concept of Michael returning as a ghost to a town now literally as well as metaphorically haunted by his 1978 rampage, and coming into conflict with a now teenage Tommy Doyle and Lindsay Wallace as an expression of their post-traumatic stress disorder and survivor's guilt. It was dark, strange, and cerebral, and by all accounts, Akkad hated it. He didn't want an anthology, he didn't want supernatural horror, he didn't want psychological horror. He wanted to evoke the same feelings that audiences got from the original Halloween and satisfy their craving for what that film gave them. But Carpenter had already made Halloween once, and the thought of making it again and again to diminishing returns killed him a little inside. So he and Hill and Yablans all sold their rights to Akkad, while still retaining residuals, a little detail that has kept Carpenter flush with cash pretty much right up to the present day, and Akkad began commissioning people to come up with pitches for sequels. The first concept, where Michael goes to the big city to stalk Laurie Strode in Chicago, was nixed when Jamie Lee Curtis made it clear that she had absolutely no interest in returning to the horror genre in general and the Halloween franchise in particular. But Donald Pleasance was available, and his presence in the film would help to connect audiences emotionally back to the original, because again, Akkad was always of the view that the original was such a touchstone for the series that you couldn't walk too far away from it and expect viewers to follow along. And certainly Halloween 3 did kind of back him up on this. So Shem Bitterman, future writer of Halloween 5, wrote a script that featured Michael stalking Laurie's daughter. After two installments that were every bit as focused on Laurie as they were on Michael and Dr. Loomis, he felt that you couldn't simply ditch the Strode family connection and move on. This screenplay wasn't used, but it does seem to have influenced the instructions Akkad gave to subsequent writers, leading to the pitch by Lipsius, Ratner, and Ruffner. With only 11 days before a looming writer's strike that would go on to devastate Hollywood, there's practically a KT layer of semi-finished screenplays, remakes, and rushed scripts that went into production in this era. It was left to novice screenwriter Alan B. McElroy, who's since gone on to write things like Wrong Turn, Spawn, and Left Behind the movie, to hammer out a remarkably quick draft for the sequel. And Dwight H. Little, who was also pretty new at the time, but who's gone on to be a very respected and highly in-demand television director, was selected to direct it. And who did they cast for the film? Well, as I say, Pleasance returned as Dr. Sam Loomis. He'd kept busy since Halloween 2, appearing in genre films like Alone in the Dark, The Devonsville Terror, Warrior of the Lost World, an MST3K fan favorite, Phenomena, Prince of Darkness, another Carpenter film. There's some contention over whether Carpenter gave Pleasance his blessing for this sequel, and the charmingly titled Frankenstein's Great Aunt Tilly. I watched the trailer. It looks like a spectacular little clusterfuck of a horror comedy. Joining him as Jamie Lloyd, the Laurie Strode surrogate for this installment, is Danielle Harris. This was technically her film debut, but she's gone on to a nice little career in film and television with some appearances on Roseanne, voice work in The Wild Thornberries, appearances in the Hatchet franchise, and oh yeah, she appeared in a Rob Zombie horror remake we'll be discussing in a few episodes' time. We have not seen the last of her. Jamie's older foster sister, Rachel Carruthers, is played by Ellie Cornell, who also helped to produce the indie comedy Free Enterprise, a cute film about two wannabe filmmakers who strike up an unlikely friendship with William Shatner, and who's had a few horror credits over the years in things like Dead and Deader and Dead Reckoning. And no, they're not connected. Dead is just a very popular word to put into your horror movie title. And Rachel's not-exactly boyfriend, Brady, is played by Sasha Jensen, who also wound up in the very influential 90s movies Dazed and Confused and Buffy the Vampire Slayer in small roles. Brady's romantic interest, in turn, is Kathleen Kinmont's Kelly Meeker. She's made a career out of appearing in action movies as the love interest, femme fatale, or trophy wife of the evil mastermind, which are, unfortunately, most of the roles available to women in that genre. She was in Bride of Reanimator, though, as at least part of the titular Bride of Reanimator, and she also appeared in 87 episodes of the practically ubiquitous syndicated series Renegade with Lorenzo Lamas. For people who watched late-night TV in a certain era, this brings back a lot of memories. Usually memories of how little there was to watch on late-night TV before streaming came along. Kelly's dad is in turn Sheriff Ben Meeker, played by Beau Starr. Starr is another one of those great Hollywood day players who started acting in the late 70s and just kept plugging away from audition to audition in everything from T.J. Hooker to Hardcastle and McCormick to Night Court and Newhart, all the way up to the 2010s where he appeared on Psych. He's probably best known, apart from his appearances here and in Part 5, for his recurring role on Due South. But really, he's one of those classic, gee, that guy looks familiar actors we love so much on this podcast. And speaking of, gee, that guy looks familiar, Michael Pataki plays Loomis's colleague Dr. Hoffman, and that's as part of a string of 178 acting credits that went from 1958 all the way up to his death in 2010 and beyond. He was in Rawhide, My Favorite Martian, the original Mission Impossible TV show, The Flying Nun, the original Star Trek and TNG, Columbo, Bonanza, Happy Days and All in the Family, Barney Miller, Little House on the Prairie, and I'm not even out of the 1970s yet. Basically, he was a reliable and talented actor anytime you needed someone to show up and get the job done, and sometimes that's a lot harder than being the star. Stars can mess up a take, blow a line, throw a tantrum, and still have a job, but people like Michael Pataki needed to do it right every single time or they'd be replaced with someone who could, and he did it for 50 years. Oh, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that he was the villain in an obscure little revenge movie called Five the Hard Way, which was repackaged and retitled for television as The Side Hackers and became an absolute legend on Mystery Science Theater 3000. And yes, side hacking is a real sport. There's still a professional racing circuit for it to this day. Finally, the role of Michael Myers for this installment was performed by George P. Wilbur, an actor and stuntman who performed stunts frequently uncredited for movies from Planet of the Apes and The Poseidon Adventure all the way up to the 2002 Spider-Man and Beyond, taking in many of Hollywood's most beloved genre films along the way. He's the kind of guy Quentin Tarantino romanticized in Death Proof and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, always willing to put himself in harm's way to get the shot. And honestly, I'd love to read a memoir of his career. And with all that out of the way, we open directly into the credits, which take place over scenes of the silent, sinister environment of rural Illinois at Halloween time. We see carved pumpkins, skeletal trees, ghost decorations swaying in the wind, and I've heard many people say it's the single most evocative description of the season they've ever seen. It looks like someone went out of their way to get real B-roll footage of autumn, which is a lovely way to begin, given that one of my few complaints about the original is the sheer slap-in-the-face obviousness of its being set in Pasadena in the springtime. We then cut to an ambulance driving through the pounding rain, heading for Ridgemont Federal Sanitarium for an appointment to pick up a transfer, one Michael M. Myers. Technically, his middle name is Audrey, but I don't know how much care and attention is being given to the paperwork for a man who's been comatose for 10 years. The security guard, played by veteran character actor Raymond O'Connor, makes something of a meal out of showing them through the high security ward, telling them, "Jesus ain't got nothing to do with this place," in a tone that suggests he gets something of an illicit thrill out of spooking visitors by showing off the worst of the worst of the worst society has to offer. He also gives a little retcon by exposition dump. Obviously, they can't leave both Loomis and Michael dead after the explosion at the end of Part 2, or we wouldn't have much of a movie. So we're told that Loomis narrowly survived, and Michael's been in a coma for the last 10 years. Apparently, they discussed giving this moment an actual flashback where Loomis pleaded with them not to treat his patient, but it was decided that the less shown of this particular moment, the more believable it would be. And yes, it is obviously implausible that not just Michael, but the much less indestructible Loomis would have lived through that, but look, I'm a comic book fan. I once read an issue of Spider-Man where both Dr. Octopus and Hammerhead were standing less than 10 feet away from a nuclear bomb when it went off, and they both made it out fine. Sometimes you just have to accept the absurdity of it all, take it as read that of course it's silly, and move on. Speaking of, the ambulance team signs off for the patient with Dr. Hoffman, head of the facility, who's relatively indifferent to Michael's comatose body and sees him as no particular threat, and who is quite evidently sick of Sam Loomis's constant insistence that the man who hasn't so much as twitched in 10 years is still dangerous. With Myers gone, my hope is that he'll either transfer, retire, or die, he snarls dismissively. And it's really kind of strange that they go out of their way to make a foil to Loomis who's this instantly and vividly dislikable, and then not give him a spectacular death worthy of his crusty old dean in a college movie attitude. I gather there were some drafts that had a death for him written in, but they just couldn't make it work organically, given that his whole point is that he's fucking off and leaving it to Loomis and the Haddonfield cops. The John Carpenter theme kicks in just as they wheel Michael out into the pouring rain, and it almost seems like the thunder booms in time to the music as they drive off. Michael's face remains bandaged, which is nonsensical after 10 years, but there's no way a COD would break with tradition to allow us to see Michael's face, even though John Carpenter did that in the very first movie. It all seems to be going pretty well until one of the doctors in the back mentions that Michael has a niece in Haddonfield. Instantly, Michael wakes up and bashes the man's head against a supply cabinet before literally sticking his thumb directly through the doctor's forehead. This effect was added by legendary special effects artist John Carl Buechler, who we've discussed as a director in the episode on Friday the 13th Part 7, when Akkad decided the picture was a little too bloodless to frighten a 1988 audience. And we should probably talk a little bit about this kill, because it does point to one of the odd aspects of this film that can be a little hard to take at times. Obviously, it's not possible for a human being, even one in peak physical condition, to stick their thumb directly through the skull of another human being. That kind of thing is exactly what the very thick, very sturdy structure of bone is supposed to prevent, and even if you could somehow force the much more fragile bones of the thumb to penetrate the forehead, the flesh around those bones would deform and tear, while Michael's doesn't. And that brings up a further point. Michael shouldn't have the strength to do any of this. He's been in a coma for the last 10 years, which should lead to severe muscle wasting and the need for months of physical therapy in order to perform even basic activities like standing and walking. This is later pointed out in the film itself, and like Michael's inexplicable ability to drive despite never having been taught, is shrugged off with a, yeah, but he's clearly doing it, so what are you gonna do? The point is, most of what Michael does in this movie is low-grade impossible, and when you combine it with Jamie's precognitive dreams about him and, well, whatever happens at the end, you're looking at the implication of a supernatural angle for any of this to even exist. And yet, Akkad hated the idea of a genuinely supernatural Michael, and Little wasn't a fan of it either. So the film keeps trying to have its cake and eat it too, suggesting that maybe Michael's just a real dude who keeps doing the impossible because he's so determined in his madness, and maybe he's an actual monster who has some sort of superhuman strength and durability because of his connection to the holiday and its rituals. Now, the original did that too, but that's the thing. You can get away with that kind of ambiguity over the course of 90 minutes in a film that's designed to have a haunting, open-ended finale. If you're going to keep on exploring it over the course of 3 sequels where Michael's supernatural feats grow ever more overt and spectacular, though, eventually people want some kind of an explanation. And as we'll see over the next few installments, it was an explanation Akkad didn't want to give and wasn't prepared to answer. But for now, at least, we're still in the sexy, fun, is he or isn't he stage of his supernatural aspects, like Maddie and David in Moonlighting, but with a higher body count. And Michael dispatches the doctor before we cut to an insomniac Jamie Lloyd, age 7. She's watching the storm out the window with the family dog by her side, yeah, don't get too attached to him, when her foster sister Rachel comes to put her back to bed. Their relationship is still very new and raw, with less than a year separating Jamie from the traumatic death of her parents in a car accident, and even though Rachel is willing to tell Jamie she loves her, she's not willing to call her a sister, which is what Jamie very badly wants. It's a very real conversation, if a bit clunky in its naked exposition, and it almost distracts you from the way that the ambulance Jamie sees outside the window appears and disappears. But when she goes back to bed, and we see Michael's face in her bedroom mirror as she passes by, we begin to understand that something strange is going on. It's obvious that it can't actually be Michael, not with his escape so fresh and the vision of him already dressed in his iconic costume, and also not this early in the movie by any stretch. And yet, somehow that makes it even more unnerving. He can't be here, and yet he is. And when he grabs Jamie and drags her halfway under the bed before she manages to escape, then appears outside her bedroom as well when she flings open the door, we realize just a beat before she does that she's having a nightmare. It's a much more tense and ominous scare sequence than a dream has any right to be in a movie like this, precisely because it feels less like a dream and more like a premonition. Again, this film is a lot more of a supernatural thriller than the previous 2 Michael installments. The one flaw in this whole thing? Well, this is where we get our first good look at the shape mask for this installment, and it's just not as menacing as the original. It's still a Don Post Captain Kirk mask, kit-bashed into something approximating the original 1978 face that we still know and fear, but something about the choice of an extremely bright white for the mask and the slightly wider eye holes and the sculpt of the mouth makes it look less blank and expressionless and more, not shocked exactly, but scandalized. As though Michael is somebody's great aunt, possibly named Tilly, who just found a man in her bed and can't believe he thinks she's that kind of woman. It's not intimidating or ominous, and it really diminishes the impact of most of Michael's sudden appearances because he looks as surprised as you are by the fact that he's there. The next morning is Halloween itself. And really, given that this whole thing comes about not because Michael chose the date to escape, but because he happened to be getting a patient transfer on October 30th and overheard the news about his family, I think there might be some legit grounds for a class action lawsuit against Ridgemont by the victim's families. Like, seriously, you couldn't wait 2 days to move him? You had to tempt fate? Then again, given that it's exactly 10 years since Michael committed the original murders, maybe there is some sort of statute of limitations situation in effect. Maybe they could only hold him at Ridgemont for so long before transferring him to Smith's Grove and time was just running out. In any event, we see kids running for the bus, some of them already in their costumes. And I really appreciate the extra time and effort they went to in these shots to include bare trees as well as a ton of leaf cover on the ground. This movie had something like 15 times the budget of the original, and some of it went to making everything look more authentically autumnal in a way I appreciate. Although, given that they filmed in the early spring, so cold that Donald Pleasance was trying to hide a hat during some of his scenes, it's entirely possible that these trees just hadn't grown in their leaves yet. At the Carruthers house, Rachel and Jamie's parents are going through the chaotic routine of breakfast that any family deals with, but it's disrupted when Jamie's babysitter cancels. Apparently, Mom and Dad have a Halloween party to go to at the boss's house that evening, and it's the sort of thing that could make or break an important promotion he's hoping for. Which means that they need to find someone on short notice, which means that Rachel needs to cancel her plans for a date with her boyfriend Brady, which means that she gets a little too snippy about it where Jamie can hear it, which fuels Jamie's fears that she's not really a part of the family and makes her run off in a huff. Which makes Rachel feel like a terrible human being, so she promises Jamie ice cream and trick-or-treating to make it up to her. Jamie's not enthused about the trick-or-treating, but she grudgingly accepts the ice cream. Back at Ridgemont, a limping and scarred Sam Loomis finally discovers that Hoffman allowed Myers to leave the facility, and the two of them have a spirited argument that ends with the ultimate I told you so, a phone call informing Hoffman that the ambulance crashed into a river and that they're having trouble identifying the bodies. The two men go to examine the crash, but as with part two, it's hard to come to a definitive conclusion. Loomis tells Hoffman and the police to keep searching while he heads to Haddonfield to warn them just in case they need to know about the situation. Which all sounds pretty reasonable on paper, but God does Pleasance turn it up to 11 in these scenes. He's almost like Ralph in Friday the 13th, a bleak and ominous doomsayer with lines like, "You're talking about him as if he was still human," and a weary, haunted demeanor that makes it clear that Michael's done his damage even if he couldn't kill the older man. It's about here that Pleasance really takes over the franchise emotionally, and he won't relinquish it until his death in 1995. He heads to a gas station, little knowing that Michael got there first and stabbed the mechanic for his jumpsuit. And by the way, Michael in the bandages wearing the hospital gown is so creepy looking that I almost wish they hadn't done a costume for him. He looks so good that way. But that's not all. There's not a single living person in the garage or the attached restaurant apart from the doctor and his former charge, and the telephone has been destroyed with a single titanic blow. The two of them see each other over the counter, with Michael already dressed in the jumpsuit but still wearing the bandages, and Loomis pleads with him to spare the town and kill him if he needs a victim. Michael doesn't listen, though, instead darting away to steal the tow truck and driving away in it, and in the process he damages the gas pumps, blowing up Loomis's car and wrecking the telephone lines that connect Haddonfield to the outside world. This Halloween, the town will be completely isolated. At school, a group of kids tease Jamie for being an orphan with a murderer for an uncle, and speaking of perfect opportunities to kill people that the movie didn't take, Halloween 4 is probably the only time a slasher could have murdered three children and gotten cheers from the audience for it. Seriously, these brats are the fucking worst. Jamie runs away, and it's enough to make her decide that she wants to go trick-or-treating after all just to experience a little bit of normality in her life. She and Rachel are dropped off by Rachel's friend Lindsay, who is, yes, intended to be that Lindsay, at the Discount Mart where Brady works to pick up Jamie a last-second costume and tell Brady the bad news about their date. At the Discount Mart, Brady, Wade, and a third teen who's intended to be Tommy Doyle make a bet that Wade will be too chicken to ask out Kelly Meeker. As the sheriff's daughter, she's kind of off-limits to the town's boys, even though she's clearly sick of being treated as such. Wade walks up to her while she's stocking the shelves. She immediately says, "Fuck off, Wade," before he can even say a word, and he slinks away. It's amusing, but it's kind of an unnecessary scene, to be honest. But I'm sure they didn't want to cut Tommy entirely out of the film. To be blunt, I think the lack of a serious presence for Tommy and Lindsay is one of the biggest mistakes the story makes, and I really do believe that Etchison and Carpenter were on the right track in making the film about PTSD and repressed trauma. I feel like if they'd foregrounded them as characters and explored the effects that night in 1978 had on them, you'd really feel the weight of those 10 years in a way you don't in this movie. Given that there aren't many opportunities to naturally achieve that kind of X years later effect that the original Halloween had had to work very hard to convincingly fake, it is kind of a shame that they wasted it by bringing back only one survivor from the original film. Although, obviously, they did try to bring back Laurie as well, but we're a good 10 years out from the point where Jamie Lee Curtis is willing to embrace her legacy as the original slasher survivor. Rachel and Jamie go in. Amusingly, they're dropped off in front of a big sign that says, Vincent Drug, which doesn't match the dialogue at all, and Brady shows Jamie where the costumes are before Rachel breaks the news to her boyfriend. Jamie finds a clown costume, one with implications that are obvious to Halloween fans, but she doesn't know that Michael has stopped by to steal a mask. Sadly, he goes for another bland, boring white face. I'd love it if this time out he wore the four-eyed lizard monster we see elsewhere on the aisle. She sees him, first as a child in the mirror wearing the costume she's chosen, and then over her shoulder in her reflection, but if Michael recognizes her, he doesn't take the opportunity to do her in. He instead leaves the store wearing his new look, and Brady is too distracted by Jamie's scream of terror and the discovery that he's been stood up to realize he's got a shoplifter on his hands. And yes, he reacts with petulant entitlement. Brady's not a good dude. On the road, Loomis is hitchhiking his way to Haddonfield and is finally picked up by an eccentric and alcoholic reverend who's driving drunk in a car that must have been 50 years old even when this movie was made, with a vanity license plate that says, Amen. He gives Loomis a drink, sings boisterous hymns, and says things like, You can't kill damnation, mister. It don't die like a man dies. And I mean, tonally, this doesn't fit in with anything else in the movie in the slightest. It's borderline nonsensical when set next to the grim, murderous atmosphere for the rest of the movie, and it's completely unnecessary. You could just cut to Loomis being dropped off outside the police station by a perfectly ordinary station wagon, and we'd understand that he'd been hitchhiking. But sometimes the most memorable and interesting moments a movie takes are the ones where it goes off the beaten path and just decides to get a little weird. And Carmen Flippy's performance, which brings out the goofy Hammond Donald Pleasance for this one scene, really sticks out in a way that makes you kind of wish the whole rest of the movie could have made big bold choices like this. I'd lose one of the kills before I cut this weird, wonderful little scene. As night falls and the kids begin trick-or-treating and playing Halloween pranks, Mom and Dad head out to their all-important party and Jamie gets into her costume. They head out, little realizing that someone is watching them through the window. Now, this film doesn't have Dean Cundey, and there's very little of that smoothly flowing panaglide camera work that characterized the first three films, but it lingers a little bit here. Michael breaks in soon after they leave and finds Jamie's shoebox full of pictures of her mother, which is an odd way of discovering that she's his target. I get that they didn't want to make an explicit telepathic connection or anything because, again, this film is not willing to commit to the supernatural angle that it's clearly edging towards. But how did he know to pick this closet, this shoebox, to confirm his suspicions? Has he spent the whole time between leaving the discount mart and nightfall going from house to house and ransacking people's possessions in order to find his niece? I'd almost rather he just magically intuited it and some ways, it's more believable. Loomis, meanwhile, finally arrives at the police station and asks for Sheriff Brackett, only to be told that he retired in 1981, presumably brokenhearted over the death of his daughter 3 years earlier. This is such a deep and weighty moment for what's ostensibly a throwaway reference. And Ben Meeker is now in charge. He recognizes Loomis immediately from 1978, and although he's at first skeptical when Loomis tells him that Michael Myers has recovered and escaped, he nonetheless takes the threat seriously and enacts a curfew, which makes him instantly sympathetic compared to the previous sheriffs in the movies, where they always disregard and ignore the threat until it's way too late. You really like the fact that he's like, no, we're going to take care of this. We're going to make sure that this does not happen again. The two of them go out looking for Jamie to take her into police custody. But she's out trick-or-treating, and as she goes to the Meeker house, ironically enough, Rachel's stunned to see Brady standing behind Kelly when she answers the door wearing nothing but a nightshirt. He chases after her, trying to make amends, but it's hard to deny the basic facts of the situation. He got mad at being stood up and decided to cheat on Rachel with another girl, and when she storms away, he doubles down on his decision by going back to Kelly's house to finish what he started. I understand that he's a teenager and prone to making bad relationship decisions, but still. My dude. At the local bar, the TV announces the curfew, and the owner, Earl, decides to call the police station and find out why everyone's closing early on Halloween night. But the phone just rings and rings, and Earl and his patrons decide to go on over and find out what's happening in person. I actually kind of like the idea of a drunken mob taking on Michael and the carnage that might ensue if something like that were to happen. In the movies, of course, not in real life. But unfortunately, the violent posse kind of remains a minor element of this film, and they don't really factor into the plot directly until the end. And we never do get a big Michael carves his way through a whole crowd of people moment, which is what we're all kind of really hoping for. Again, in the movies, not in real life. Instead, Rachel loses Jamie while she's arguing with Brady and has to go looking for her through the neighborhood, while Loomis and Meeker go to the Carruthers house and confirm Michael has been there by finding the corpse of the family dog. Because Michael hates dogs. They station a deputy there in case the kids return and start driving through town looking for them. But Michael's decided to stack the odds in his favor by going to Haddonfield's electrical substation and throwing an electrician directly into the power lines, plunging the town into darkness. This electrical station must be ludicrously close to the neighborhood where the Carruthers live, given the timing of events, but this isn't the time for me to explain the effects of high-voltage power lines and electrical substations on property values, so we'll just leave it for now. Jamie, having realized she's gotten separated from Rachel, begins looking for her, and yes, you can see some of those classic painted gourd jack-o'-lanterns in the background. But both girls soon begin to realize that something is very wrong when they see a still, ominous figure appearing and disappearing through the shadows. A tense chase ends with them reuniting with each other just before Loomis and Meeker catch up to them. But just then, not one but several figures dressed like Michael come out of the shadows. But just when you're thinking, holy shit, are we gonna get a fucking incredible Ghostface level twist where there's several copycat killers operating in Haddonfield? Loomis draws his gun on one, and they turn out to be just some dumb kids playing a prank. They run off laughing, which is not at all the reaction I'd have if I realized I almost got shot by a paranoid man with a gun. And Loomis and Meeker take the girls back to the station, not noticing that one of the Michaels is not fleeing, and is watching them. And when they get back to the station, they discover that Michael, who has been remarkably fucking industrious during this period, has killed all of the cops. Again, it's not that I think it would be impossible to murder one or more cops, or even to rip them apart with his bare hands the way Michael seems to have. It's that he's going all over town to do it, on foot. Absent some really weird editing, or some supernatural teleportation abilities, or possibly just that Haddonfield is a town so small that it's possibly a singularity, this is a little sketchy plot-wise. As they leave the station, the mob arrives, and Loomis decides to rile them up by telling them that Michael Myers is out there on a killing spree. His logic is, well, it's not the worst I've ever heard. He figures that with the police force reduced to Meeker and the deputy at the Carruthers place, more warm bodies hunting Michael can only be a good thing, even if they are drunken idiots. But I really sympathize more with Meeker's God help us, and his realization that drunken idiots with guns out looking for trouble is never a good thing. They decide to stash the kids at Meeker's house and summon the deputy to join them, but in one of those okay, but why? Moments that happen a lot in late period slashers, Michael has predicted this and is hiding in the back of the police car waiting for him so he can catch a ride to the Meeker place. So he cut the power, cut the phone lines, albeit accidentally, wiped out the cops, and then went to lie down in a cop car and hope he didn't get noticed on the off chance that the cop was going to take him to Jamie and spare him the effort of hunting her down? I mean, he did see Jamie getting driven off in Meeker's car, so it's theoretically possible that he could make a plan to create this kind of chaos and let the cops lead him to his prey, but he certainly had all the luck in the world in carrying it off, and it does seem like a very convoluted plan. The cop doesn't even see him, which, yeah, see all my previous rants about how impossible it is to actually hide in the backseat of a car, and how this only works in movies because we conflate the character's eyes with the camera's perspective? Anyway. Meanwhile, the drunken posse goes out and kills Ted Hollister, one of the locals. Point for Meeker. Back at the Meeker house, Brady and Kelly are just getting down to sex when the house is suddenly flooded with cops, irate parents, Kelly's romantic rival, and a small child in what has to be the single worst piece of timing in the history of intercourse. They manage to get their clothes on before they're seen, but Brady is soon dragooned into service in securing the household, and Kelly winds up having to make coffee for everyone. Meeker and Loomis try to use the emergency radio in the basement to reach the state troopers, but reception isn't good. None of them know that Michael has gotten out of the cop car, somehow managing to open the rear doors from the inside, another low-grade impossibility, and slipped into the house. There's a little interlude that follows here as everyone boards up the house and discusses their feelings about the events of the film so far. Kelly gets defensive with Rachel about her romantic relationship with Brady and gets a cup of hot coffee splashed on her forehead. Thankfully, she apparently makes pretty tepid coffee because she only acts shocked, not hurt. Jamie falls asleep, overwhelmed by events, and the deputy takes up a post right next to the front door where he can't be surprised by someone trying to get in. Said deputy, by the way, is played by George Sullivan. Loomis decides to go to the Carruthers house to see if Michael's been back, because he can't be here for this next sequence without forcing some serious narrative backflips to explain why he doesn't just die. Meeker gets in touch with the state troopers, who send help, but when he finds out about the death of Ted Hollister, he goes out to confront the mob. Which never happens. We don't get that sequence. That's because originally he was supposed to die in the house as well, getting thrown in the furnace right after he got in touch with the state troopers and setting the house on fire, but budget cuts prevented that from being realized on screen. Instead, the carnage kicks off when Kelly brings the deputy his coffee and finds him dead and Michael sitting in his chair with his shotgun. But instead of shooting her, Michael shoves the barrel of the gun straight through her belly and into the wall behind her, pinning her in much the same way he did with Bob in part one. Again, this is not physically possible. It's just not. But we're going to suspend our disbelief because at this point, we're starting to feel like Michael is not a normal human anymore. As Loomis put it, perhaps nobody can stop him. Rachel, who's monitoring the radio, goes up to tell everyone the state troopers are almost there and instead finds the two bodies. She goes to get Jamie, but the little girl has woken up and wandered off, and all she can find is Brady, who says, sorry, she's probably already dead, we should just go and save ourselves, and tries to leave, only to find himself unable to use the front door like a normal person. Okay, that part is really more the screenwriter's fault than the character's. Apparently, Meeker has a deadbolt on his front door that needs to be unlocked from the inside as well as from the outside, which is what they call in the industry a fire hazard special, I believe, and it's got a steel core so he can't even shoot the lock off. It's a blatantly unbelievable plot gimmick to prevent them from just leaving when they realize Michael's inside, and while I do love the set piece that follows, it is pretty damn hokey to come up with such a kludge to make it all happen. They finally find Jamie on the second floor, but Michael is already heading up the stairs after them, and Brady sacrifices his life in an attempt to slow Michael down that's not quite as sweet or as sad as I think the filmmakers were hoping it would be. It's noble, yes, but it's also deeply stupid and ineffectual. And I just haven't really connected with the character enough to feel him as anything other than an obvious victim from the moment he first appears. As it is, I find myself thinking that if he'd just run up to the attic with the others, he'd be alive right now, because he sure didn't do much to stop the masked killer. Instead, it's just Rachel and Jamie who make it up onto the roof. Rachel shouts back at Michael, "Leave us alone!" at one point, and it would have made the whole movie worth it if he'd just gone, "Oh, okay," and left. He does not do this, of course, and a very tense rooftop crawl slash climb slash chase ensues that would have been a whole lot tenser if the whole house was on fire like they'd planned, and now I really wish that was the version we got because OMG, wow, that would have been spectacular. It ends with Rachel lowering Jamie to the ground using some loose cable from the rooftop TV antenna. See, kids, back in the day they had these things called TV antennas. Only for Michael to shove Rachel off the roof. She lands hard and gets knocked unconscious, and Jamie is forced to flee on foot to draw away Michael's pursuit. Michael gets down to the ground ludicrously quick. Again, borderline supernatural at every point. That said, it's a genuinely heartbreaking moment, especially because neither Jamie nor the audience knows whether Rachel is alive or not. It's just a small, frightened child alone against the actual boogeyman, which is such a great concept that it's amazing they don't do it more in this franchise in particular and in slasher movies in general. They probably don't do it more because they're worried about traumatizing child actors, although Wilbur in this shoot made sure to take off his mask after every single time they said cut to reassure Harris that everything was make-believe. Apparently he was a lot more convincing to her than to the people in the neighborhood when they did location shooting, because the police were called at one point due to her screaming, and it was inaccurately reported that someone tried to kidnap her from the set. In any event, she's not alone for long, because Loomis pops back up to help her out now that the bloodbath is over. They decide to hide in the school nearby, figuring that Michael will head straight for the Carruthers, but the school is locked, and shooting the door open, see Brady, that's how you do it, sets off an alarm that alerts Michael to their presence. He throws Loomis through a plate glass door. Famously, he's blonde in this scene due to the use of the wrong, incorrectly prepared prop mask, and begins chasing Jamie. Just as he catches up to her, though, Rachel blasts him with a fire extinguisher, picks up her sister, and runs out with her. They're found by the drunken posse, who initially want to go in and hunt Michael, but instead decide to get Jamie to safety. They drive off toward the nearest state patrol substation, but Michael, somehow, made it out of the school, past Rachel and Jamie and something like five other guys, and clung to the back of the truck just waiting for them to get to an isolated spot so that he could pop out and kill them one by one. Suffice to say that of all of the impossible things he does in this movie, this is probably one of the impossiblest. Michael murders everyone in the back, then climbs on top of the cab and grabs Earl by the throat, ripping it open in the process, and yanking him out of the truck. Rachel climbs into the driver's seat and takes over, swerving and braking and speeding up in a desperate attempt to shake him off that finally works. She then runs him over. In the original script, she was supposed to back up and give him four more hits, and knocks him down an embankment. But she loses control of the vehicle in the process and crashes. The cops and the state troopers finally arrive, just as Jamie's drawn by an inexplicable compulsion to approach Michael. She holds his hand for just a moment, but as he begins to rise, she flees back to Rachel, and Michael Myers is shot another dozen times before his body is swallowed up by a sudden and unexpected sinkhole. It appears that the nightmare is finally over. But really, it's just beginning. Because when Jamie and Rachel come home to their parents, trauma is etched on every line in Rachel's face as she contemplates the deaths she saw. And Rachel's mom goes up to draw a bath for Jamie, only to be stabbed repeatedly by a masked figure with a pair of scissors. A figure that turns out to be, in a chilling callback to the original film, Jamie herself. Loomis tries to shoot her, recognizing that whatever evil Michael held inside him has now passed to a new host and a new generation. But Meeker knocks the gun out of his hand and we're left with that terrifying, ambiguous question of what she's going to become. But unfortunately, it's not possible to stay with that ambiguity forever, much as we'd like to. In the end, everyone wants to see the next installment, and Halloween 3 proved to Mustafa Akkad that they don't want to see a Michael Myers-free Halloween film. So we're going to get a resolution to that ending that's doomed to disappoint some people, even though it's really more that Halloween 4 promised something that no sequel could deliver. But more on that in a couple of episodes. For now, will I hang on to this movie? Well, yes and no. I do like the movie. It's maybe trying to do too much, and it's really around here that you can truly begin to feel the tension the sequels strain under in trying to hew closely to the original while still striking out in their own interesting direction, but it's still got a lot of exciting set pieces, and the main characters are very sympathetic. But the version I found is so bare bones that it doesn't even have subtitles, and that is a deal breaker to me when it comes to DVDs, because I just feel like it's an accessibility issue. I have an easier time following words on screen than I do dialogue sometimes. So I'm only keeping it until I can find a better edition, and then I'll let it go, because I'm not a fan of movies that aren't complete. And if you want to talk about missing subtitles, ambiguous endings, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter at @halfhorror and on Tumblr and Letterboxd as @halfpricehorror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror... Well, I threatened this one all the way back when I did my episode on Suspiria, and now I've finally found a DVD copy. We're going to look at the weird, quirky, genre-defying indie movie Chompy and the Girls, with voice work by horror legend Udo Kier, and discover just what makes a person decide to swallow little kids with a mouth the size of a washing machine. See you then.